nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
I'm very glad to be here in my old department and many old friends here. George Honig being my oldest friend. I think we published our first paper together in 1958 or something like that. And since then, many other papers. I remember as a PhD student, when I left this place, there were almost about 20 publications from Purdue. I was here for 3 years for a PhD. And then I went away to Berkeley. Well, very nice to be here in Purdue. And of course, this tremendous expansion of Purdue in physical plant, real buildings, it's unbelievable. Well, I hope Purdue really becomes one of the very top universities of the world in the near future. And doesn't mean it is not now, but even better than what it is. Okay. I've been working on a variety of materials in the last 55 years. Well, you can see how old are you, I won't tell you. Well, in another year or so, I'll approach 80 years old, but I have a very big research group. One of the major areas I worked on in the last 15, 20 years have been nanomaterials. In addition to oxides, just like George, we have been working on all kinds of oxides. In fact, I wanted to give a talk on this here, but later I was told by somebody I didn't give this topic to you because there's not as much interest in oxides here in chemistry department. Because they're really much more interesting than these materials because I'm working on multiferroics and magnetoelectrics, which are really fantastic. When I apply a magnetic field, it shows electric polarization. When I apply an electric field, it shows magnetic polarization. Very fantastic materials. With interaction between order parameters, magnetic and electrical order parameters, and so on. So today I'm not going to talk about that. But in nanomaterials, one of the things that always fascinated me were the carbons. Of course, it all started with the discovery of fullerenes. After that, of course, nanotubes. And then, of course, came graphene. Graphene is only a very recent discovery. And I always keep repeating this. Please don't ever forget that people have been trying to make graphene for about more than 50 years. Except they didn't know how to make a single layer graphene. It is only the luck of these guys, the two Russian guys, who somehow put a scotch tape and pulled off a layer, okay? And so, this is two-dimensional graphene. It is considered to be mother of all graphitic forms because if you stack it, you get graphite. If you roll it, you get a nanotube. We can also make a buckyball out of it. So it's sort of a mother of all graphitic forms. And then this is the most important slide. Why is it this Novoselov and this Grime get a Nobel Prize? It's just this because of this one frame, okay? What they found was the energy of the electrons is linearly dependent on the wave vector near the crossing points in the Boulogne zone. In other words, it is a zero-gap material. Second, it shows quantum Hall effect at room temperature, very high temperature, which is very, very unusual. And then this ballistic transport of carriers, these properties are the ones that are so impressive, never known in solid-state physics or chemistry. No material ever showed it. Because, you know, when you have electrons in a solid, there's scattering, there are defects, but not here. The electrons go ballistically. So this got them a Nobel Prize. So we'll start off. But these guys, what they did, how to get one layer of graphene out of graphite, all they did was put a scotch tape and peeled off. And what they did was this, took a crystal of pyrolytic graphite, peeled off a layer, and get that single or two layers. And then, of course, you measure the thickness of that by we get 0.8 nanometer thickness, that is two layers. 1.2 nanometers would have about three layers. If you have 0.3 nanometers, you will have single layer. You can measure the differential height and so on. That's what they did. And this is their paper in Science in 2004, which was around that time. They were able to characterize these graphenes nicely. Well, the way we characterize is something I just showed. I prepared this just to make it a bit educative, this seminar. You can get transmission electron microscopy. If you have orient the material right, you can get two layer material or a single layer. More importantly, if you are really single layer, on a substrate of silica of this kind, 300 nanometer silica substrate, you actually see through it. It's completely transparent. In fact, that is how I decide whether you have a single layer or not, where I can see it, and I know you get that experience when you see that. Well, and then of course you can do very high resolution scanning microscopy and find out about very atomic resolution microscopy. Well, where chemistry comes is, in fact, chemistry is so important in graphene research, mainly because you cannot go on peeling off single layers from graphite crystals. If you wanted 1 gram of material, somebody estimated nicely, and I think in the physics magazine, it would cost about $30,000. You go on peeling off one layer at a time. You can never make it, in fact. In fact, the single layer graphene is unstable. You can't put it in a bottle. As soon as you make gram of it, all of it will become graphite again. So, you can only keep it stable on a substrate or in a dispersion. So that is where chemistry comes in. So most people use this method, taking graphite powder, oxidize it, get graphitic oxide. Graphite oxide you can exfoliate and then reduce various ways using microwaves, reducing agents, and you get not actually graphene. I want to change this. I don't know why I've not done that. You get reduced graphene oxide, which has all the properties of graphene, except it has a few oxygen functionalities because it is not completely clean surface. But of course, the reduced graphene oxide you get like this as a different Raman spectrum. So it's not really graphene. But for all practical purposes, most applications people use this. Of course, there are many other methods. I gave this method, which is purely a Bangalore method from my lab, by arc discharge in hydrogen. You get graphene, which is usually not one layer, but usually 2 or 3 layers. There are many articles even from my lab that tells you what are the best methods of making graphene, and I will not go through all those things. One of the important methods we found some time ago was you can make single layer graphene oxide, very nice, the yellow solution. You can put it in sunlight outside the window, slowly it becomes black. And that is graphene, you see. So in fact, by irradiation of single layer graphene oxide, you can make a fairly good sample of graphene, but again, it is reduced graphene oxide, not completely graphene, because these oxygen functionalities in single layer graphene oxide, carbonyl group, all kinds of ethers and so on, most of the oxygen functionality can be eliminated by irradiation with whatever radiation source. So this is a very good method. I even always joke this is a good physicist method. You don't have to do too much chemistry, and you can put it, shake it, and show it and irradiate something. So this is a very useful method. This is something we use it quite often. In fact, we have used this method to make lithography. I will not talk about that. For example, you can see beautiful lithographic patterning we have got using this method. Start with the single layer graphene oxide, irradiate it, you get graphene. So all those things are conducting now because they have a graphene, and we can even do electron beam lithography using this simple transformation by irradiation-induced reduction of single layer graphene oxide. Okay. Having said that, this is a summary slide of various methods of making graphene. I will obviously not read it out. This is started with micromechanical cleavage. One of the very good methods many people use, we have also done a lot of work on that, is doing chemical vapor deposition or decomposition of hydrocarbons like methane or ethylene on metal surfaces like cobalt or copper. You can get very good single layer graphene. And this is the arc discharge I told you. These are all few layer graphenes. You have various methods now available for graphene synthesis. So in the last three, four years then, we have really, not more than 4 years, 6, 7 years, I would say, we have progressed enough to say we can make graphene of various kinds in the laboratory. This just to show you a summary frame to show you all the techniques we use to characterize graphene. It's very important. Unfortunately, I referee papers where JSAS or Angamata or whatever journal, people take one technique and characterize it, and it just never complete unless one characterizes it properly. This is the usual field emission scanning microscopy. You can see the fluffy graphene, very, very light. As you know, 1 gram will be this big. There's a lot of stuff, low density. And then you can see the nice TEM show that two lines is obviously two layer graphene, and high resolution thing where you see every atom and you do the analysis. This is the kind of thing I do quite a bit in aberration free microscopy. And then most important is the atomic force microscopy. You have a little chunk of graphene, you measure the height, of course this is not a very good sample, it looks like this is looks like about 3 or 4 nanometers, about 8 or 10 layers. Anyway, you have to do that. And this is my own technique. I use surface area. I may come back to this later, because single layer graphene, theoretical surface area, experimentally you can't do that, because as you told, you can never keep that single layer separately. 2,500 square meters per gram, very high surface area, if it were there. Therefore, if you make graphene samples of various kinds, you can measure the surface area. In fact, we have got up to 1,800 or nearly 2,000 square meters per gram in many samples of graphene. Of course, the last technique, the most powerful technique, spectroscopic technique, is the Raman. Of course, being an Indian, I am very fond of Raman spectroscopy. Raman, I tell you, has become the most powerful spectroscopic tool in the last few years. If you come through New York Airport, you all go through Raman scanners. I hope you know that. That's how you know you don't have any detonators and terrorist bombs and so on. Various things, and all kinds of whatever, dope and so on. Very nice, and so on. Okay. Raman spectroscopy, I will come back to that later. It is a wonderful technique. Why it is, unfortunately, that alone I give a usually half an hour talk on Raman of graphene and nanotubes. It's a very fantastic spectroscopic thing in Raman. My friend Millie Dresselhaus in MIT, she has done a lot of work in this. Millie, in fact, laid some foundation to Raman spectroscopy. For those who may not know, Millie Dresselhaus was a very young, she is roughly my contemporary. She is just 80 years old, a couple, 1 or 2 years older than me. Millie Dresselhaus, when she was doing PhD in this country, she actually predicted the properties of graphene. But there was no experiment, no one to see what she was saying. So graphene is a pretty old subject for those who are theoreticians in physics. So this Raman spectroscopy is a very powerful tool, as I will show you in a short time. What we have done is we have been able to make graphene and also dope it in our laboratory by a usual technique using diborane or using ammonia, pyridine. We can make a boron doped or nitrogen doped graphene, and we can study properties of that. Don't worry about the Raman spectroscopy here. What is most important is one of the bands in the Raman spectrum, the G band, as they say, which is characteristic of the sp2 carbons in general. In benzene, you see, you get a band around 1600. There is nothing but a G band, equivalent to G band of graphene. It is a tangential mode in the Raman. And that mode is very sensitive to doping, you see, very, very sensitive. So when you dope with nitrogen or boron, that frequencies go up. The stiffening of these Raman bands is something very, very interesting in chemical doping. When you electrochemically dope graphene also, you get that stiffening, and that's how we, in fact, titrate the amount of doping in graphene in terms of either electrochemical or chemical doping. So we can do that. Okay. We talk like this, you can't give information on everything, but some of the beauties of the recent research. Lot of people are interested in graphene nanoribbon. If you have taken a course with George Honig or somebody here in quantum mechanics long ago in advanced physical chemistry, they would have taught you particle in a box very nicely. And I learned particle in a box a lot here in Purdue. Well, you see, if you take graphene in a big sheet, suppose you cut a ribbon, in a small ribbon, in a big sheet, you just cut a small ribbon, in a small one. See, what happens then is, you see, the electrons get confined in a very little strip. And it is like a particle in a box. The electron states in a graphene ribbon is different from graphene. Graphene has a Avogadro number of electrons, you can say roughly, but not here. Not Avogadro, but it's larger than. So how to make, and the properties of graphene ribbons, there is a lot of physics in it. In the last 3-4 years, we see physical review letters or any other journal, a lot of work. And how do we make them? See, this is again chemistry. You take a nanotube, oxidize it, and it opens up. You see, this is a ribbon. A nanotube, depending on the diameter of the nanotube, depending on how many graphitic layers are in the nanotube, you get a ribbon. Of course, unfortunately, you see, the ribbon has oxygens in it, because it's permanganate, sulfuric acid, and all. They oxidize the edges. Of course, you see, this is the kind of ribbon you get. Little strips. We have done all that. But recently, we have done found a very, very nice way of doing it. You see, the oxygens at the edges destroys the electronic structure. We don't want oxygens. So the best way to do it is by laser unzipping. It's something we did last year. Take a nanotube. You see, this is in the process of being unzipped, and eventually you get a trace. Very nice strip. And this is nitrogen and boron doped. Graphene nanoribbons have also been made by this simple laser unzipping. These are all the tricks and techniques we use, and many others are doing that. I'm only giving some of the results from our laboratory. Well, I'm not going to talk much about this. We have done a lot of work, and many others have done it as well, on functionalization of graphene. You see, I guess there is not much nanotube research in Purdue. I was always disappointed. There were actually not enough people doing the very, today, the frontier area, if you take material science, one of the areas is carbon nanotubes, the other is graphene. In this, there is very little work at Purdue. I don't know why. Carbon nanotubes, we functionalize it, because for many things you have to functionalize surfaces, otherwise it is no use. For example, you want to make a composite, you want to do something else, you want to make it dissolve in some solvent. How do you make graphene soluble in a solvent? Okay, so that is the problem. So one is covalent functionalization. For example, you can take graphene, oxidize it, thionyl chloride, get acid chloride, long chain amine reaction, you get this amide derivative, it will be soluble in any of these solvents. You can do number of other kinds of covalent functionalization, except that if you functionalize too much, you destroy the electronic structure of graphene. So this is the problem in carbon nanotube research. You want to functionalize, retaining the electronic properties of nanotube. You can never do that if you functionalize too much, because if chemistry changes, all sp2 carbons become sp3 carbons. So it's a problem. So this is therefore we do non-covalent functionalization, where the sp2 carbons are not affected. You can wrap it with a surfactant or use pi-pi interactions. You take the graphene is a big pi system, so put another pi system which can wrap around it and then dissolve, make it soluble in solvents. We do many of these things routinely. See, another thing is, being a pi system is extremely sensitive to electron donation and electron withdrawal, charge transfer, as they call it, in molecular charge transfer. Yeah, you see, for example, if the G band of graphene has been put on a weighted scale here, G band of graphene, in the Raman, you put electron withdrawing molecule like TCNE, the frequency shifts to the right, that is increases. When I put electron donating molecule like tetrathiofulvalene, it goes to the left, that is softens. So this is a very interesting thing, namely molecular charge transfer changes the electronic structure of graphene. And this probably is useful in a variety of applications and technologies, and I'm not giving too much information on this today, but it's very interesting. We have done a lot of work on this charge transfer of this molecular charge transfer. For example, here is a typical thing on pi-pi interaction and charge transfer. Here is a graphene, a few layers. I put a very nice pi system like coronene with four carboxyls. It's a coronene tetracarboxylate, which has therefore four withdrawing groups, so which makes it a good withdrawing system. At the same time, there is a pi system. The minute you put it, it goes on the molecule and also exfoliates beautifully. We had a little communication. Kemi Roje, Jennifer, and of course you can see all the color changes. I'll not be. In fact, for those interested, this trick of using coronene tetracarboxylate, I had a JACS communication last year, where you put single-walled nanotubes, you put this coronene tetracarboxylate, it binds preferentially to metallic nanotubes, precipitates out. So in a one-step separation of the single semiconducting and metallic nanotubes is a very, very burning problem in nanotube research. You have to separate the semiconducting and metallic nanotubes. We had that by using the same molecule last year. Okay. And another thing is, if you have all kinds of pi donors, you put the pi donor aromatic system, aromatic molecules give transfer, very nice fluorescence. Graphene is a big fluorescence quencher. It quenches fluorescence of molecules very nicely. And we have studied the decay kinetics and so on, decreasing the lifetime. And this fluorescence quenching, we have also shown by doing the transient absorption spectra, is due to electron transfer. This is the first experimental observation of electron transfer between graphene and electron donor molecule, which we believe there is a very nice review just come in JPhysCam where they quote our work and others, and they say this may be of great use in designing in organo photovoltaic material. This work has since been verified nicely in Notre Dame by Kamat with porphyrins and other things, where he has also shown electron transfer between graphene in the excited state, electron in the excited state. So graphene and the molecules. Well, I'll skip that. Graphene you can decorate with metal particles and look at the properties, and to skip that, the most important property that we have talked about refers to the magnetism of graphene. You see, this again, I was looking at literature, which is 45 years old. Again, people like Millie Dresselhaus and so on in MIT. Is carbon magnetic or not? That is the question. The people used to worry about that many years ago. Nobody knew. And now that we have graphene, you can do very good work on that. All the graphene sample, you can look at the zero field cooled and field cooled magnetization data. It doesn't matter. These are all different samples. What is interesting is they all show ferromagnetic hysteresis at room temperature. The graphene is magnetic. Because of the edges, there are several theoretical papers on this already, because edges have lone pair orbitals, don't forget. The lone pair orbitals in graphene give rise to the ferromagnetism. And of course, the bulk is essentially antiferromagnetic. It is like in oxides, you know, we have a frustrated material or an oxide where there is a coexistence of antiferromagnetism and ferromagnetism. They give curves and figures exactly like this. We see similar materials, similar hysteresis. In this. And what is interesting is that there's a paper in Science and another one or two in Physical Review letters and so on in the last few months where people have actually found magnetoresistance, very high magnetoresistance. Unfortunately, some of the papers, I don't like the magnetism, magnetic fields have used very high magnetic field, 12 Tesla. I don't like magnetoresistance, 12 Tesla. What do you do with such a high field? So we have found that even 1 or 2 Tesla or 5 Tesla, 4 to 5% magnetoresistance. I have not yet published that. We have put that in some article in a paragraph, but they were still looking at some magnetoresistance. And these are all the unusual properties. You may say, why magnetoresistance? Let me tell you why. Many people are using, you know, instead of using very complex materials, maybe graphene can be used as a spintronic material. This is one of the interests many people have in Bell Labs and places like that. But I don't think they will be able to use it as a spintronic material. But anyway, some of them write such articles, maybe to get it published in Science or Nature. But actually, I don't think they will actually find it to be useful. But anyway, there are many electrochemical properties. It can be used as a supercapacitor. A lot of papers come in this area now. Use of graphene as a supercapacitor. It has wonderful field emission properties, very low turn on, much better than, in fact, it's much better than carbon nanotubes, actually. I hope you all know this. There are many flatbed displays coming out of carbon nanotubes. You see, if you apply voltage, that's the right kind of voltage, carbon nanotubes emit electrons, and you can make very nice displays. What is that Korean company? They made very nice flatbed displays, Japanese companies. So I feel that it's much better to use graphene because they're very low turn-on, much better field enhancement factors, and very stable. You see, these are all what do in our lab, but very nice light-emitting properties. Very stable over time, and this is another property that I want to mention. Well, I don't think we should worry about these things. Just I'm trying to show how we do measurements of electrical properties. I forget that. Recently, we have found, graphene has no gap. The gapless material. To introduce a gap, you remember I used reduced graphene oxide, a little oxygen, that will have a little gap. That gap is just about the same as infrared wavelength of infrared light. So you can use this, it has just come out in advanced materials, where you can use this very nicely for infrared detection. And in fact, this is a response to hand. If you take in my detector, put your hand, it shows the signal. Take the hand, the heat radiated by your hand is enough without having any fever or anything. So if you have fever, it shows better signal. Okay. So leaving that aside, it's a very nice radiation detector. I'll skip that, the ultraviolet detector. Mechanical properties, we have graphene incorporated in polymers. It does show improvement in the elastic modulus and strength, but more interest will be published that in nanotechnology some time ago. In PNAS, a couple of years ago, I published a paper. This, I think, is a very new finding. When you take graphene and add to it a one-dimensional small amount of nanotubes or a nanodiamond, which is zero-dimensional, you get very high synergy in mechanical properties. This can be used. A lot of aircraft companies in this country are very much interested. They all seem to be working on it. They are also coming to talk to us quite a bit on this property of graphene in strengthening polymers. Okay. I told you about hydrogen uptake or surface area. This is a typical surface area plot. It's not a good graphene sample. Even then, it is 925 meters per square meters per gram. Some of them can get you 100,500. Hydrogen uptake, we have done not very good. It's about 1.78% ordinarily at one atmosphere. But at high pressure, we can get about 3.5-8%. So just the carbon nanotubes, you see, there's a big expectation of carbon nanotubes as being hydrogen storage material, no good at all. It's only about 3%. This is also same, 3-8%, just to store by adoption. Carbon dioxide, you can get fairly good, up to 30-35-8% carbon dioxide uptake in most graphene samples that we have studied. Don't worry about this, much more detail, which I'll not talk about it. We are trying to reduce graphene sieve instead of storing hydrogen by adsorption, reduce graphene. So you can use there was a paper in Science which they said, where they said they did reduce graphene by using a plasma, hydrogen plasma. We did that. By doing that, we could only get 1.25 or 1.88% of hydrogen. So it is not very good at all. The theoretical amount of hydrogen you can put in graphene is 7.78%. Because for every carbon, you can put one hydrogen, so it's 7.78%. So it is only this much. So we actually did chemical reduction and by Birch reduction to start with. Here we get excellent hydrogen uptake. You can see this is a graphene sample. I hydrogenate it. You can see the CH stretching bands in the infrared spectrum exactly where you expect. And I'll not bother about the Raman spectra today. That also will not. And so we've been able to get up to 5% hydrogen. The Department of Energy wants 6-8% to run cars. That ships in, 6.5-8%. We have not reached 6.5. Up to 5.5 we can, but I'm not going to vouch for it. 5% definitely. But the beauty of this hydrogen that we put in is all of it comes off. You see, if you warm it, all the hydrogen comes off. That's what you want. You want hydrogen storage where you put hydrogen, just by doing something, all the hydrogen comes off. Use a fuel cell and run your car or airplane or whatever. But whether this can be used for that, I don't know. We published this in PNAS, thinking it was important. You can see this one here, you see. Here is a graphene sample, hydrogenated. You get the CH stretching bands in the infrared. You warm it, you go on losing it until all the hydrogen goes off. In other words, the sp3 carbon you create by hydrogenating, that forms a bond with hydrogen, CH stretching bond, CH bond, which gives you stretching vibrations. But when you heat it, that bond dissociates very easily. The reason is, the graphene which is planar becomes non-planar when you put hydrogen, so that tremendous strain energy, which is doesn't favor the sheet anymore. It prefers to be sheet, nice planar sheet. However, the bond energy is exothermic. So that competition is the one that determines. We have worked out the detailed theory of the decomposition of the CH bonds in this PNAS paper. All that has been reported. But we can also, don't have to heat it. You can just irradiate it by UV light or some excimer laser. It goes off. All the hydrogen goes off. Whether it will have any practical application, I can't tell you. But I am very pleased with the good chemistry that you can do 5% hydrogen. I wish it were 6%, but we are not. But some chemists, better chemists can do that. I'm sure you can increase the hydrogen. I have not bothered about it. I just shown this in my interest ceases when the principle of it is okay. And if I find some good chemistry student who want to do it, we can probably do more work on hydrogen storage. Okay. We can also do chlorination and we can put chlorinate graphene and all the chlorine comes off if you warm it. Because the same principle, same with bromination. So we have done that type of thing as well. Okay, this morning in Nano Center, when inauguration, I talked mainly about inorganic layered structures. I spent a few minutes on that here. I have got very much interested not only in carbon but inorganic layered compounds, because if you as I mentioned in the morning, you know, if you remember historically when fullerenes were made, the next thing that people worried about is why only carbon? Why are we so obsessed with carbon? After all, other layered compounds like molybdenum sulfide or boron nitride must also form fullerenes, because that was done by Reshef Tene in Israel in Weizmann Institute for the first time, and I showed this. This is a fullerene type structure of niobium sulfide, which is a layered compound made by Tene. And this is a tungsten sulfide. This is made by us in Bangalore, hafnium sulfide of some sort, beautiful fullerene type, hyperfullerene type structures. So the same thing is true. We also can make nanotubes. I'll not be talking about that. So just like carbon nanotubes, a large number of sulfide, boron nitride, a whole bunch of nanotubes have been made. These are nanotubes of all kinds of sulfide, selenide. Those interested, towards December 2009, I have a perspective in Advanced Materials on the inorganic nanotubes. This is known. So why not graphene-like things? So we have been able to make graphene-like materials of many layered materials, inorganic, in the last 2 years. This, I think, is very exciting, very interesting. Well, this again you can do by scotch tape technique, which you have done. You take a molybdenum sulfide crystal, put scotch tape, get a mechanical, that we have done. So I'm not going to talk about it because there is nothing exciting about that method. But you can do a lot of chemistry. You can do lithiation, N-butyl lithium, and then do exfoliation. And then you can do hydrothermal synthesis, all kinds of. This exfoliation is not a new technique. You see, the reason you put lithium and you put it in water, the tremendous force with which lithium reacts with water and gives out hydrogen, everything gets exfoliated and you get single layer material. These are all chemical methods. We had an angavantakemi couple of years ago. In this, and since then we have done many more things. One of the first things that happens when you make that is the 002 reflection in the X-ray diffraction pattern, which corresponds to the registry along the C direction, disappears as soon as you make a single layer compound or a two layer compound. And the Raman spectra, of course, changes very nicely, shifts and broadens. I may have a chance to talk about it later. And can do very good microscopy. Here is a aberration corrected microscope image of molybdenum sulfide. Every atom you can see, you can photograph the images very nicely. And you can calculate the band structure which you have as a function of number of layers. What happens to the gap as a function of number of layers? What happens to phonon dispersion? All this, and what happens in Raman spectra, we have the theory also has been done by my co-workers in our center. This is similar tungsten sulfide. You can see the electron microscope. These are all two layers, three layers mainly, and this is very nice image of a single layer tungsten sulfide in a high resolution microscope. We have done a lot of work on that. Similarly, we have done molybdenum sulfide, tungsten sulfide, similar chemical methods. And I'm showing various images, how they look like, two layers and so on. You can see thin flakes, how they look like. We have to do AFM and characterize them. High-resolution microscopy. Here is a single-layer molybdenum sulfide. There are two layers. You see the difference in the electron microscope. You can analyze that. You do a Fourier transform, and you do all kinds of microscopy, and you can find out what this represents and interpret the microscopy. And again, you see these inorganic graphene-like compounds are also magnetic. You see that, but very low, very small saturation magnetization, but they're all ferromagnetic. In fact, for those who may not know, 3-4 years ago we established, and now well accepted, there are several hundred people who are referred to our papers in PhysRev and other places. All nanoparticles are ferromagnetic. TiO2 or aluminum oxide, magnesium oxide, zinc oxide make small particle because of surface defects. They are, for some reason, they are also room temperature ferromagnetism. There's a lot of theory also people are working on. Today I'll not be talking about that. But the molybdenum sulfide is ferromagnetic. Also molybdenum selenide also is ferromagnetic. And I'm just throwing The reason is, you see, you get beautiful edges, zigzag edges in molybdenum sulfide, just like in graphene. This is a nice picture we took some time ago in the lab. You can get very nice zigzag edges here. And these edges partly are responsible for the magnetism. And we can make very nice field effect transistors. This is the molybdenum sulfide field effect transistors that we have made, and others have made too. And you see what happens in molybdenum sulfide and all. You see the Raman modes, the A1G mode softens, you see, as you decrease the number of layers, while the E1-2G mode stiffens, the frequency increases as you decrease the number of layers. We follow that. We also do properties of the transistor, looking at the hysteresis and very various properties of the transistor. We have just now made, this unpublished, molybdenum selenide, which is even better than molybdenum sulfide. We have made very nice transistors of that. More than that, because there is the right kind of gap in molybdenum sulfide, selenide, it is even as good or even better infrared detector than graphene or reduced graphene oxide. So we have looked at that recently. And this is a material, gallium sulfide, gallium selenide. These are very well-known materials, just like graphite, which are layered materials. We have looked at, you can see, these are single-layer gallium sulfide material or gallium selenide. We have looked at these. These are all the chunks. You see, they are of gallium selenide graphene-like materials. And we have looked at the Raman. This is a very busy slide, but what I'm trying to show is, if you take one of the modes, A1G mode, you see the frequency of this mode decreases, or it band softens as you decrease the number of layers. On the other hand, you want to take A2-1G, the frequency increases, it stiffens, and we have looked at all these details of gallium sulfide, gallium selenide, and look at the Raman spectra, and we have also made similar studies on gallium selenide, and then made transistors of these layered materials, gallium sulfide, very high on-off ratio, but mobility is rather low. The same is true of transistors of gallium selenide. We have just completed this work, not yet done. This morning I showed this. We have worked on layered niobium selenide. You see, we made 5-layer niobium selenide. It is a superconductor. The work done Bell Labs many years ago. The superconducting transistor is 8.5K. And the bulk sample is that if you increase the number of layers, the transient seems to be going. This work is still going on. Lastly, boron nitride. We have done a lot of work by high temperature reaction. We have made single layer boron nitride. Very interesting. These are the nice images of boron nitride. Few layer boron nitride. Here boron nitride high resolution image where you can see all the atoms. And then, we can functionalize boron nitride to make solutions of graphene-like boron nitride with very high surface area, up to 900. Boron nitride with such high surface area is not known. We had ACS nano on this some time ago. What is interesting is we have also done band structure of all this boron nitride as a function of number of layers. This again, boron nitride is magnetic. The graphene-like boron nitride is magnetic, and this magnetization increases with the decrease in number of layers and so on. So there are a number of things. And again, we have looked at the properties of boron nitride as a function of number of layers. What happens to mechanical properties? If you have fewer layers, it strengthens polymers much better. And this kind of work has also been done. Lastly, I'm going to close my lecture with this. Again, I show very few slides here. This work going on. I'm very proud of this work because these are materials not known at all before. We are doing on, you know, carbon is known. Boron and nitrogen are elements next to carbon. Why not put boron, carbon, nitrogen, make boron carbon nitrides instead of graphene? But BN is a six-membered ring sheet, and carbon is a six-membered ring sheet. Why not? So we have looked at, we are doing a lot of work on this. We can do high surface area borocarbon nitrides by this high temperature reaction, or a gas phase reaction of boron trichloride, methane, and ammonia. We can make the very nice crystalline type of samples. We can make all kinds of samples, vary the composition, for example, with BC1.9N or BC1.6N or BCN, and so on. So we have been, in fact, there is one paper in Chemistry European Journal before this. I don't know why it was not cited. This is another one that came last year on these things. What is interesting in these materials is these are very, very high pickup for carbon dioxide. This borocarbonitrides at low temperature pick up 128 weight percent of CO2, unknown to any other solid as far as I know. Very high CO2 uptake. Same with methane. Methane usually 14-15% is high. This goes up to 17% at 273 K. But at room temperature, even then 65 weight percent CO2 and 17 weight percent methane. And these are we are very proud of these numbers. There are a lot of work going on in this. What I'm not showing you today is, I mentioned this morning in the letter, is that we have done a lot of work on selectivity of this BCN. Suppose you have a mixture of nitrogen and CO2, which is a common thing. Well, it is very selective to CO2. It doesn't pick up nitrogen. There is a very interesting, same with methane, we have done selectivity of borocarbonitrides. I've not mentioned this is the same thing in detail. I think before I close, I must mention this one talk, in this talk, something that is going on just now. You know, boron nitride is an insulator. Well, graphene is a good conductor. Suppose you borrow carbonitrides, you can imagine them as domains of boron nitride and domains of graphene together. Well, what will be the electrical property? What is interesting is, this is a very bad curve because my mistake. I didn't update these pictures here. We have done a lot of work on this. It shows it's an insulator. Suddenly it becomes metallic at low temperature. This is a fantastic property. Why does it happen? Well, actually we can vary the temperature up to 140 K depending on the composition. So we are looking at the origin of insulator metal transition in borocarbonitride. By the way, all this work we are doing on borocarbonitrides and so on, it won't work if you just do experiments. You need the help of theoreticians, and for each one of them, I have very good theoreticians. Really, they're one of the best theoreticians we have in India. Dr. Wagmare, he's done a lot of calculations. He's now doing very detailed work on borocarbonitrides, including understanding insulator metal transition, dielectric properties, surface properties, and so on. So that is what is happening in my lab. And in addition to this, we are also looking at now other layered materials. Instead of why graphene, why not other kind of layered materials? Make one layer. Suppose I make one layer molybdenum oxide, what happens? Nobody knows. I want to find out. As you know, molybdenum trioxide is a well-known layered material. Suppose I make just single layer of that. And similarly, single layer dielectrics and number of problems in this area that have come up because our interest in graphene. You know, if graphene had not come, probably we wouldn't have thought of all these problems. But if graphene came, so we thought of inorganic, other mimics, now other types of layered materials. These are all some of the things we are working on. Well, I'd like to thank a whole bunch of PhD students. He's Dr. Vagu now. He's also Dr. Subramani. There are three doctors now. She's also a doctor. And other postdocs who were with me. And the many professors with whom I have collaborated. So thank you very much.
So Professor Rao has shown tremendous energy here one day after his travel from India, and hopefully there's a little bit in reserve.
Yes.
For questions. So,
very nice talk. Going back to some of your earlier absorptions, you have 2% hydrogen and 35% CO2.
Correct. That is graphene.
Right. So why don't you quote mole percent? If you convert to mole percent, are they similar, or the weight percent is misleading?
No, I know, but you know, it depends on the journal. We put both. Actually, that journal wanted us weight percent. I don't know what I would do. Yeah, we do. It's just, you are right. But, we can do mole percent.
The other question was, maybe it was a false color, but in your luminescence, you had it look like a green luminescence from the...
Graphene?
Yes.
Graphene itself doesn't have much of a luminescence. It has fluorescence or emission. But molecules have. What we are putting is a molecule.
Ah,
which has a fluorescence, and when I put graphene, it quenches it completely. And because of the excited state electron transfer, it has to be electron transfer or energy transfer. In that case, we have studied with the electron donor molecule, it seems to be electron transfer to graphene. That's what I tried to.
The boron carbon nitrides, BCN, have you tried the hydrogen absorption?
Yeah, we have done that. It's not very good. Adsorption is no good. I didn't find good enough. So I didn't mention it, about 2-3%.
Even when you have graphene, you have 5%.
No, 5% is when I hydrogenate it. Adsorption, you only get at ordinary one atmosphere, about a couple of percent or less.
But then you release it at very high temperature.
500 is not high. A car exhaust is 800 degrees, and engine is 1,000, and not much. A car exhaust is enough to decompose it, but you don't need that. Why don't you put ultraviolet light next to it, it will decompose.
So, how does the
methane associate with graphene?
Methane, actually, what we have found, I don't have the latest. The heat of adsorption of carbon dioxide and borocarbon nitride is very large, 7 kilocalories bond, very high. Normally, carbon dioxide doesn't bind so strongly with most surfaces, 7 kilocalories. Methane is about 3.5 kilocalories. So they are fairly, well, it's like a hydrogen bond, you may say, but it's not bad. Normally, you don't expect. The reason is, in borocarbon nitrides, we have highly localized sort of a, well, you want to call it polarons, you don't want to use that language. There are dipoles of various kinds where positive and negative charges are separated. That's what theoretical things have shown. Where it looks like they provide very nice active centers for binding to molecules and also giving rise to unusual electronic and other dielectric and other properties. So I didn't talk about that. That's what I said. These are all, we have done the heat of adsorption of CO2. Very various samples. The lowest we have got is 6 kilocalories. The highest we have got about 7.5. So, about 6 to 7 kilocalories is pretty good binding of CO2 for a surface of this kind. Graphene doesn't have such a binding. Graphene is less than 3 kilocalories. But BCN makes high binding CO2.
Sure. Have people tried to stuff things other than boron and nitrogen into graphene?
No, but that's more interesting, you know, in semiconductor physics is boron and nitrogen.
Yeah.
Nitrogen, there has been a lot of work. Actually, in Stanford, I tried to do that. Number of people, they repeated and, of course, cite our work, but they go on doing the same thing. I don't know why. It's all been done. Nitrogen, a lot of people are doing that.
I mean, phosphorus?
No. But, no, phosphorus we can. Yeah. You know, I don't want anything to happen to my graduate students.
Yeah. I understand.
It is a danger. I don't want to work with phosphines and arsenes in my lab. I tell you, we had a very, with those interest in why you can say, yeah. I had a very unfortunate experience in our lab when I was head of the department. One of these crazy guys, one of the faculty members, who is still around, he went on making this young girl, very pretty girl actually, a little girl, and we went on making her reduce all these arsenic compounds in hydrogen. Arsenes were coming out, and he had a regular lab, and there was no real proper exhaust, nothing, and in the end she developed some unusual illness. She left the department, of course, never got a PhD. She was a daughter of a very good friend of mine, not even a good friend, my student, my former student, his daughter. But, you know, I decided I will never work on, you know, I won't take a chance on arsenic and phosphine in a lab with large-scale phosphine. Unless in semiconductor doping, that you can do.
Yeah.
But here I have to do chemical reaction.
Which,
I avoid it. I'm sure it can be done.
Yeah.
It can be done. But
be interesting too.
Yeah, phosphorus is easy. I'm sure you can dope it. I don't want to do it.
Arsenic. Here.
Arsenic also, I'm
yeah.
sure.
Yeah.
I know.
Okay. Student in the room. Good opportunity. Any student? Okay, Aaron.
So when you hydrogen and graphene,
yeah.
Is it hydrocarbon?
Or hydrocarbon.
Graphene hydride.
Well, what do you mean with graphene? Benzene becomes cyclohexane. What do you call that? You call it benzene hydride or cyclohexane?
So if that's the case, so what is the carbon?
Well, the best it can become is cyclohexane.
Right.
But cyclohexane means it becomes non-planar. It become a chair or a boat or whatever. But this, it doesn't become cyclohexane completely because it completely doesn't hydrogenate. Some carbon centers are left.
So the hydrogenation product, do you follow that by analysis by Schopenhauer?
Every possible technique. I have not shown that. We do every possible technique, looking at the protons, looking at the infrared spectra, Raman spectra, we have done that. I didn't show all that. We can do that. They look like cyclohexane CH bonds.
So it's completely forms cyclohexane?
Not completely, it doesn't form because we have not hydrogenated completely. There are a few carbons, so some of them are not cyclohexane.
Right. If hydrogenated
completely, you would get cyclohexane.
Right, then you would have more than 5% hydrogen.
More than 7.7, exactly 7.7, but we have not got it. Somebody can do it, maybe they can do it, I don't know. That is what I said. I have not done it because, you know, nobody in our organic chemistry, why is it organic chemists don't do the proper techniques and all, I don't know. Why don't they have a hydrogenation at high pressure? Nobody does more than 50 or some atmosphere. They have a very good hydrogenating facility I don't have anywhere in India. You know, this may require a bit high pressure. I couldn't do that. So I said palladium hydrogenation I couldn't do. I said hell with all organic chemists, I will do my birth reduction. But, you know, no one could help me. No, look at that. They should do hydrogenation. And why is it they didn't help me? I don't know. I'm not an organic chemist.
Okay, last question goes to Tim Zwick.
Well, yeah, I was just wondering.
I'm sorry, I'm just joking.
Okay. I just wondering, you said at one point the boron carbon nitride was heterogeneous in the sense that there were graphene pieces.
No, not heterogeneous. There's one structure, but there are domains.
Okay.
They're one structure. They're complete. They're not pieces put together. You know, this work, what it shows is boron nitride. See, in this structure, you cannot form BB bonds, NN bonds. Otherwise, you can make BC bonds or CN bonds and so on. So, boron nitrogen will have BN bonds and then it links up to carbon. You get bonding, except that it is not completely BCN substitution. It is not a ring of BCN only. It can be, from what we see, it can be domains of BN and this. That is what. But we have done.
I'm just wondering whether the adsorption, when you put CO2 on, would it go into particular?
Yes.
Is it an average over?
No, we have done only experiment. The theoreticians find it goes to specific sites. In fact, there is a paper of mine in Chemistry European Journal on that. Which sites do CO2 bond to? Towards the end I came with, I didn't show all that. They show a specific site for CO2 adsorption. That is what I've told you. They have certain specific sites which give rise to very unusual surface as well as other electronic properties, it looks like.
Okay. Thank you for a very lively talk and discussion.